morning. My name is Attorney Jeffrey Jensen, and I represent Calvin James. Mr. James, along with approximately 30 other people, was charged in 2005 with being part of a conspiracy to distribute cocaine in the Milwaukee area. Locally, the case was known as the Cherry Street Mob case. Only three of all of the defendants who were originally charged proceeded to trial, and that was Mr. James, along with Ted Robertson and Jarvis King. The case lasted approximately 7 days of testimony, and it really wouldn't be possible in the time I have here this morning to go through all of the facts. But I did want to talk about some broad themes that I've tried to develop in my brief. And the broad theme is that there's a strategy, I believe, that's been developed by the government that really amounts to a shortcut to putting many people in prison and skirting the rules of due process. And that is, Mr. James, along with many other people, was indicted. I got the discovery not long after the case was charged, and I went through it page by page, talked about it with my client, and found almost no evidence that Mr. James was involved at all in this conspiracy. But he stayed and I challenged whether that was appropriate, that he should continue to be charged in this conspiracy, despite the fact that you couldn't tell from the indictment what he had allegedly done in order to become part of the conspiracy. You could read all of these thousands of pages of discovery and still not really discern exactly what it is the government said that Mr. James did. And I filed a motion, which I guess if this were a civil case would properly be called a summary judgment motion, asking the court to dismiss these charges against James because of the fact that there simply was no evidence. I didn't succeed. The government responded to that motion by simply arguing that he's been indicted by a grand jury, probable cause is found by that body, and therefore the rest of this is a trial issue. Well, time went on and time passed, and it wasn't until approximately 2 years, nearly 2 years after Mr. James was indicted, that suddenly, and this was only weeks before the trial started, that I started getting debriefings from all of these other 20-some defendants who had reached plea agreements, been debriefed as part of it. And then suddenly, for the first time, we start seeing allegations that at some time back in the late 80s, Mr. James was selling cocaine on a street corner with two or three of the other defendants. We see allegations from some of these cooperating defendants that Mr. James may have answered a door on one occasion at one of these drug houses. And then we find out from Dale Huff, who really is the mover behind all of this entire conspiracy, that Mr. James was not trusted in selling drugs, but he provided other services, such as being a driver for Mr. Huff when he would drive around Milwaukee, such as being a bodyguard, so to speak, when Mr. Huff would go out to clubs, and also from time to time answering the door if he happened to be in one of these drug houses that Mr. Huff was operating. And as I put in my brief, it's somewhat frustrating to me that we can't on appeal talk about the credibility of these witnesses, because I tried as hard as I could in my cross-examination of these cooperating defendants to point out for the jury that not one of them said anything about Mr. James until shortly before this trial started, and now for the first time having given four, five, I think in one instance, 60 briefings where they said nothing about Calvin James, now suddenly they do know about Mr. James.
Mr. And the Jensen, if I could just clarify the nature of your argument here, is it in the nature of a challenge to the sufficiency of the trial evidence, or is it a challenge to the factual sufficiency of the indictment, or both? And if it's the latter, you know, what's the legal authority for that,
right,
apart from the Law Review article that you cited?
Well, I raise all three of those issues. The first issue was whether the district court erred in denying my motion to dismiss. That was made pretrial on the grounds that there wasn't any evidence. Mr. James also consistently challenged during the course of the trial the sufficiency of the evidence, and he raises a sufficiency of the evidence claim here on appeal, and thirdly, whether the evidence was sufficient to show that he possessed a firearm in conjunction with the offense. And the reason I took this overarching broad brush approach is because I think it's all part of the same game plan on the part of the government in convicting people based not on evidence but on rumors and things heard around the street and the questionable recollection of cooperating defendants. And I think all of those three issues piece together, and I'd be here for an hour and a half if I addressed every one of them individually, as I would like to do.
Well, Mr. Jensen, on your summary judgment process,
yes,
it's a loose use of the term. On the civil side, there is a provision in the rule that requires the non-movement to pony up its evidence. And there's no equivalent on the criminal side, is there?
No, we would be charting new ground if I were to succeed on that issue, but it's...
What would we base that on? What could we base that determination on to grant you the relief that you want on that?
Well, I did admit in my brief that challenges to the sufficiency of the evidence before the grand jury are severely frowned upon. But this is really born out of my frustration with defending these cases. And I'm here pleading with people who I think have the authority to do something about it, that this is just not fair.
Authority where? How can we create a summary judgment process for the criminal context?
Well, the way I would do it if I were sitting on the U.S. Court of Appeals is that this is a motion that can be decided pretrial without the presentation of evidence. So I think it's appropriately brought as a pretrial motion. And once the issue is raised that there is that counsel in good faith has reviewed all of the discovery materials.
So much of that discovery, by the way, is voluntary, isn't it? The government's not obligated to provide statements of other witnesses or anything other than statements of your client, his criminal record, scientific testing.
Right, that's what Rule 16 says.
So we should expand that rule, I suppose, as well, to require the government to pony up all of the statements and names and addresses of witnesses and so forth so you could depose them and give you deposition rights?
Well, I think that the rule could be made without expanding Rule 16. I was going to say that in the Eastern District, if the government follows the open file policy, which is a local rule, it basically is mandatory that we receive all of this material. But what I had in my mind is either an affidavit or, in this case, as I filed, a motion alleging that we have reviewed the discovery or the evidence that the government has presented. We can't see any legal basis for this defendant being charged. And the government could defeat that with a one-page affidavit or a 10-minute evidentiary hearing where they create a material issue of fact.
Of course, unlike the civil context, they can't depose your client and elicit evidence from your client.
Well, they can't depose the defendant, and I don't think they should be allowed to depose
the
defendant.
Could that be why there isn't an equivalent rule to Civil Rule 56?
I don't know exactly what the reason why is, but if I were making the rules, that wouldn't be one of them, because the government always has the burden of proof in a criminal case, and they're case should never depend on whether the defendant's going to testify at trial, so I wouldn't make such a rule. But I think the three issues that I've raised do knit together to show that, you know, Mr. James is kind of a sad person in that he may have done some things early on in his life. He went to prison. He got out of prison and developed a severe drug problem. And he was associated with all of these people who were making thousands, if not millions of dollars, dealing large amounts of cocaine in Milwaukee. And he had nothing. He depended on Dale Huff for food, for transportation, for drinking money, things like that. And it raises the question, as I pointed out in my brief, concerning the sufficiency of the evidence to support the conspiracy. Is James more like the guy in Townsend who sold sugar to the bootleggers, knowing fully well that they would use it to make moonshine, Or was he more like a person who is integrally involved in the conspiracy, where he was making money, where he had all of his own customers, where he had a stake in the venture, so to speak? And if you make that comparison, I think it's clear that Mr. James is more like the man who associated himself with people who were involved in a conspiracy. He provided services to this person who may, and it may have objectively somewhat made his life a little easier when it came to running his cocaine conspiracy, but it certainly did not make Mr. James part of this conspiracy to distribute cocaine. He was a person who rendered services to Dale Huff, a driver, a bodyguard, a doorman,
well,
things
that
like
that. It was all for the purpose of drug distribution, right?
Well, I think if you were to ask Mr. James, or if you were to review the record, what was the reason? The reason was so that Mr. James could get the crumbs that fell off the table, so to speak, to feed his own drug habit. I don't think Mr. James had knowledge of the extent of this. I don't think he did anything other than provide services directly to Dale Huff to make Dale Huff's life easier. Thank you.
Mr. Coffey?
May it please the Court, I'm Attorney Dennis Coffey, and I appear on behalf of the appellant Ted Robertson. Contrary to one of the remarks made by Mr. Jensen in his presentation, I don't believe that there is a conspiracy proven on the facts of this record at all. I, in my brief, submitted a quote from Justice Jackson about ideas tend to run themselves to the limit of their logic. In this particular case, the government presented evidence that over a course of 16 years, a group of people, 29, 30, if you add in unindicted co-conspirators, more than that, were associated with a neighborhood in which most of them grew up. During the course of that 16 years, those that I would describe, if you were to take criminal records or criminal history as a measure, if you were to take the quantity of substance sold as a measure, most of the major players identified by the government were for significant periods of time not present in the area of Cherry Street, but rather were imprisoned. The evidence in this case establishes that there was an ongoing competition between what is in essence a revolving set of individuals. The testimony of almost every witness testifying for the government pursuant to a plea agreement was that they were at one point allied with A and B, another point D and E, and when they had those two alliances, there was no going back from the second one to the first. There is a common figure, Mr. Huff. Mr. Huff is a big-time cocaine dealer. Mr. Huff has a Chicago source. Mr. Huff is selling to all of these people, but even that is on different terms. Some people have it fronted, some people have to pay for it, and in some instances, Mr. Huff opens houses, and so he has employees. But he acknowledges that everything had moved off the corner of Cherry Street as these people got older. It remained their neighborhood, but they had gone out to the sidelines. I submit that what the government really indicted in this case, and the focal point of its argument, was that the common activity that agreed to had to do with turf. It didn't have to do with a commercial operation. It didn't have to do with person A being interested in the profits of person B. They were, in fact, in conflict. Groups fell off with one another. People dropped out of the group completely, came back at a later point, were imprisoned. The government in its brief says this is an atypical conspiracy. It's not hierarchical. It is atypical in that what the government said at trial and what it continues to say in its brief is that this is really about how did these people control 29th Street. A 16-year period, they had Mr. Huff testify that on one occasion there were people selling outside one of his houses and he had them moved. There was one other occasion where another individual said that they shot up a house. No evidence other than the statement of that particular individual. And that individual, it turns out, is allied with Mr. Huff, and in a debriefing with the government said he didn't even meet Mr. Huff or know anything about 29th Street till Mr. Huff was already incarcerated, long after any alleged activity of enforcement. There was a telephone conversation intercepted. It was played during the trial, where an individual from this group calls my client, who happens to be in a bar, and says, come on, I want you to come help me. There are some guys outside my house. My client's response is, nah, don't worry about it. Come on down and party with us. And that's what the evidence was. That's what he did. The government says multiple times that my client is, in essence, acting as an enforcer. They have no proof of that other than the two instances I've talked about this morning. It is not a situation where there are common interests. The very pages of transcript referred to by the government in its brief to support this notion also contain significant statements that my client controlled nobody with respect to cocaine dealing. My client did not operate in common. Everybody was going to their own table to eat. And these are all parts of the testimony about what was going on here. My position is there is not a conspiracy. I can't for one instant stand in front of this court and say that there were not individuals or groups that at a given time had a common purpose, common object, common plan. They conspired.
In that regard, Judge Stantmiller did give a multiple conspiracy instruction.
He did.
Didn't he? And doesn't that address the concerns that you're raising on appeal?
It addresses the concerns except for the question of whether the jury, and I understand the standard in this court when you start talking about sufficiency of evidence. But yes, the instruction was given. Yes, there was all of this testimony. But I don't know, and I don't think anyone can reasonably know, if the jury decided my client conspired to enforce as opposed to conspiring a single conspiracy to deal in controlled substances. Thank you.
Mr. O'Bear.
Good morning. My name is Kirk O'Bear. I represent the appellant Jarvis King. The issues presented by Mr. King's situation, although he does raise a Rule 29 issue, the other seven issues that I've raised, I believe, are the more significant ones for this court to examine. I'd like to start by addressing the issue of whether or not the prosecution unlawfully penalized the defendant for exercising his constitutional rights. Days before trial, the government filed an 851 information. There's certainly nothing wrong, according to the case law, by waiting to the last minute, but it's very telling if you look at the transcript from the sentencing hearing that Assistant United States Attorney Dan Sanders did state that it was in response to Mr. King exercising his right to trial. And we're left here with a quandary that an individual must choose between the potential for life in prison or sacrificing his right to take his case to trial. It is significant to point out that the discretion that the prosecution has under Section 851, certainly, to be sure, Congress did intend for the courts and for the prosecution to address recidivism and for someone who has prior convictions to face a higher penalty. However, the manner in which it was conducted in this case is basically vesting sole discretion to determine the sentence with the prosecution. That essentially is a judicial function that the U.S. Attorney's Office does not fill.
Those arguments have been rejected long ago, and this is a very common form of plea bargaining that has been approved by the Supreme Court.
It certainly is.
So you're kind of swimming upstream with this argument.
I understand, but I think under the circumstances of this case, Justice Sykes, the...
You've just promoted me.
Yeah.
Congratulations.
I'm just a judge.
Judge Sykes, I'm sorry. Under the circumstances of this case, we must look at whether it truly accomplishes the goal that Congress had in mind. Mr. King was the second youngest of all supposed co-conspirators, if we want to use that term. That's how they were charged. He was approximately 22 years old when the alleged acts occurred. When he was 19 years old, he had these two convictions that count as the predicate offenses under 851. He had two very minor, although felony, convictions that he was sentenced on within days of each other, served a concurrent sentence of 1 year in prison, and that's basically the recidivist notion that is being addressed by all of this. Significantly, in 1988, when this conspiracy supposedly started, Mr. King was 6 years old. There's another issue here that relates to how these prior convictions were, you know, in terms of the timing of them. There were two distinct periods of activity that the government alleged constituted Mr. King's participation in this conspiracy. One period of time when he was approximately 13 years old, one period of time when he was 22 years old, on either side of his one-year prison sentence where he was serving time for his two convictions, his two prior convictions. There was no differentiation in the jury's verdict as to what time period we're talking about. It's entirely possible, and we don't know, whether the jury viewed the evidence predating his prior convictions as more credible than that evidence that was presented post-dating his prior convictions. There was a failure of specificity in the verdict there.
Did you submit a proposed instruction asking for a jury finding on that?
I did not, and I don't believe it's the defendant's burden to specify and have the jury narrow that portion of it. The fact of the matter is that the jury found participation in a conspiracy that extended over a 16-year period of time. That was the verdict. And essentially, it's entirely possible here, and we don't know from the record or the jury's verdict, that Mr. King, that the jury did not find that he participated in any conspiratorial activity after his prior convictions. We simply don't know that. The court concluded that it had no discretion. There's a very complicated legal argument in my brief that I ask you to look at again that deals with statutory interpretation. And the fact that if you really read the statute in the context of others, one interpretation of the statute is that the court really did have interpretation in that regard. Judge Stadmuller, and you know Judge Stadmuller, he's a straight up and down kind of sentencing judge, by the book kind of guy. He found that if he had had discretion in this case, he would not have imposed a life sentence. And having appeared before him many times, I know he means what he says when he says that. I've never had a case where he deviated from what the guidelines normally recommend. He even suggested that in the context of this particular case, it may in fact rise to an Eighth Amendment violation, given Mr. King's posture, his status. And significantly, when you look at other co-defendants in this case, there were people that were dealing drugs when Mr. King was 6 years old all the way through 2004, over a 16-year period of time. Some of those people are now back out. They've finished their sentence. Mr. King serves a life sentence as a result of the procedural posture in this case.
Thank you, Mr. Robert.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel. I am John Manning, and I represent the United States in this case. If I could begin just touching on a couple things that Mr. Jensen said. The court, I believe, is correct in pointing out that what Mr. Jensen is proposing is essentially the equivalent of a civil motion for summary judgment. That is squarely foreclosed by this court's case law in Fasnacht, which requires only that an indictment allege the elements of the offense, give the defendant notice of what he's up against, and give him the availability of imposing a double jeopardy complaint later on. The indictment in this case clearly satisfied that, and the defendant is entitled to no more than that. With respect to Mr. Coffey's argument, I would submit that Mr. Coffey is asking the court to go in and reweigh the evidence the jury considered. The standard of review, obviously, is much more deferential than that and requires only that this court find that a rational jury could have found the facts as submitted. And the United States would submit, based upon its briefing, that the facts establishing Mr. Robertson's participation in the conspiracy were overwhelming. Those facts show that from essentially the beginning of the conspiracy, except for periods of his incarceration, that he did participate in the conspiracy both as an enforcer and as a drug supplier to other members of the conspiracy. Additionally, I would note as well that the court did give a multiple conspiracy instruction, and therefore the jury is presumed to have understood exactly what Mr. Coffey is attempting to re-argue here today. And then finally, with respect to Mr. Aubert, I would submit that the arguments he raises with respect to the government's filing of the Section 851 notice are all squarely foreclosed by cases as cited in the United States brief. I would respectfully disagree with his characterization of my colleague's reasoning. As the sentencing transcript reveals, Mr. Sanders went to great lengths to get Mr. King to come in, cooperate, and plead guilty so that he would not have to file the 851. The timing of it was to give Mr. King the optimum amount of time, the maximum amount of time, to take advantage of that.
Is Dale Huff the only common actor over the course of the entire conspiracy? I mean, this is a pretty long conspiracy.
You are. I think there are several common actors. I think this is a classic conspiracy where you have a core of individuals, and that core I would describe as Dale Huff, Ted Robertson, Calvin James, Kenyatta Grant, and the Hoods, Marlon and Percy Hood. They are the core of the conspiracy around which all the events revolve. The conspiracy was to distribute drugs and to protect within a particular territory, the Cherry Street neighborhood, and that core maintained that territory through threats to outsiders, which were established by the evidence, as well as by warning each other of police presence. And then within that market that they had essentially given to themselves, they regularly supplied each other with distribution quantities of cocaine and cocaine base, and often did it, you know, as this court has looked for, on a front basis.
It is true that some of these people were in and out of state custody on drug charges during parts of the operative time of the conspiracy?
That is correct, Your Honor. But there were always core members who were out on the street, and I think as these courts' precedents established, and I would point to Sophie and to Mahalius, it doesn't matter if membership changes over time so long as the common agreement remains in place. People can come and go. And that's what happened here. There were times when Ted Robertson was in prison, times when Dale Huff was in prison, yet this core agreement to distribute drugs in this Cherry Street market to exclude competition remained in place from 1988 through 2004. If there are no further questions from the court, I would submit on the brief.
Thank you, counsel.
I would only point out to the court that Mr. Manning has again said to this court, the conspiracy is to distribute controlled substances and to maintain security over a part of the neighborhood. That's not a violation of federal law. And that's the problem with their indictment and their multiple conspiracies and everything else, is they want everybody to focus on protecting turf. Protecting turf is only an overt act, if you will, in furtherance of a conspiracy. They don't have to prove an overt act. I understand that. But the point is, you can't stand in front of this court and say, amend your indictment to say it's controlled substance violations and protect the neighborhood. And that was the focus of their closing argument, their evidence, and this appeal. And I would ask the court to find that there were, in fact, multiple conspiracies. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Coffey. Mr. Jensen, Mr. Aubert, you were appointed to involved in this case. The court thanks you for your taking the assignment and your representation of your clients. The case will be taken under advisement.